KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Why are Michigan jobs in Canada? And that's what the president's going to address. He's going to say, come on back.
More tariff whiplash as President Trump gives automakers a one-month reprieve.
For Wednesday, March 5th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, the deputy FBI director is typically in a political position.
But this one has expressed plenty of controversial partisan views on his podcast.
Also, we'll dig into the origins of vaccine skepticism and the story of one bad scientific study.
It should have never been published. You can't say anything about causality because there's no control group.
Plus, a job fair in Philadelphia for federal workers who just got laid off.
Now I'm day two into forced retirement. So it's been extremely upsetting.
And the art of the Saturday Night Live portrait.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Word of a pause in intelligence sharing by the U.S. with Ukraine is concerning some lawmakers. That even as some Trump administration officials say they do not believe the move is permanent. The pause comes as the Trump administration seeks to force Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky back to the bargaining table on Trump's terms. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
U.S. officials, including National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, they've indicated that a pause might be short-lived if President Trump determines Ukraine is serious about moving forward with peace talks. But the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, said cutting off intelligence support to our Ukrainian partners will cost lives.
NPR's Tom Bowman. The administration has also halted military aid to Kyiv, underscoring President Trump's willingness to play hardball and his shift to a more conciliatory approach toward Moscow. Vice President J.D. Vance traveled to the southern border to highlight the Trump administration's efforts to reduce illegal crossings and drug trafficking. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports he was joined by the Defense Secretary and Director of National Intelligence.
The trip followed President Trump's joint address to Congress, where he touted a dramatic crackdown in border crossings. Vice President Vance, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard received a helicopter tour of the Eagle Pass area on the border and also met with local law enforcement.
Every single day that we continue to keep this border safe, that means less migrant crime, that means less fentanyl coming into our communities, that means more safety and security for the people of the United States of America.
Vance defended the administration against questions about interior enforcement. He said they are working on a plan to make it easier for those here illegally to return of their own accord, but he did not give details. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
U.S. automakers are breathing a sigh of relief after President Trump said he'll give them a tariffs reprieve. Wall Street investors apparently also relieved. NPR's Maria Aspen has more.
President Trump is giving U.S. car companies one more month without his new tariffs. He's imposed 25% taxes on goods imported from Mexico and Canada, but he told the big three automakers that they will be exempt until April 2nd. The U.S. auto industry has been vocally opposed to Trump's tariffs. Car companies warn that they will create major disruptions to their North American supply chains, and analysts say the end result will be much higher prices for consumers. Shares of Ford, GM, and other car companies rose after plunging earlier this week. However, the reprieve is still only temporary. According to the White House, Trump also warned automakers that they would need to start moving production to the United States. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow, the Nasdaq, and the S&P all climbed more than 1% today. You're listening to NPR. The Trump administration put out a list of some 440 federal properties it's identified as either up for sale or closure, though just hours later the list came down with fewer properties listed, and by this morning it was pulled entirely. Among the properties initially identified as being deemed not core to government operations, the FBI headquarters and the main Department of Justice building. General Services Administration, which put out the list, did not respond to questions about changes. Southern Californians facing a long recovery from wildfires that destroyed thousands of homes and other structures in January continue to recover. LA's Evan Jacoby brings us the story of a group of volunteers racing to save treasures that might have otherwise been overlooked, historic handmade tiles on chimneys left behind in the carnage.
Phase 2 of Altadena's cleanup process is underway, where lots will be bulldozed. Eric Garland co-founded the volunteer group Save the Tiles.
What will be lost is not only the very last of old Altadena, but for that homeowner, beautiful handmade art from over a century ago.
Many tiles were made by Ernest Batchelder, whose pieces are collected in architecture museums throughout the country. But Stanley Zucker, another co-founder of Save the Tiles, says their value isn't just in art history.
Everything on this lot that was important to them has been channeled into the tiles.
The group hopes to rescue tile for over 200 homeowners. For NPR News, I'm Evan Jacoby in Altadena.
Crude oil futures prices took a further downward bump today. Oil dropped $1.95 a barrel to $66.31 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump has decided to give U.S. automakers a break on those steep tariffs on imports of goods from Canada and Mexico that went into effect this week, but only until April 2nd. It's the latest in a series of whiplash moves on tariffs. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson has been keeping track of the back and forth, and she's at the White House. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
It was only yesterday that these 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico took effect, and today things have changed. What happened?
There's a carve-out now. The big three automakers, GM, Ford, and Stellantis, who have been hit hard because their supply chains are so integrated between the three countries, U.S., Mexico, and Canada, to make a car. The parts travel back and forth over the borders many times. So they appealed for a break, and they got one, along with all the other U.S. car companies. And here's how White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt explained it.
We spoke with the big three auto dealers. We are going to give a one-month exemption on any autos coming through USMCA. Reciprocal tariffs will still go into effect on April 2nd, but at the request of the companies associated with USMCA, the president is giving them an exemption for 1 month so they are not at an economic disadvantage.
So USMCA is the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. That's a trade deal, a free trade deal that Donald Trump himself negotiated in his first term to replace NAFTA. So up until now, there have been no tariffs on any products between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And now the U.S. car companies are going to get a reprieve from Trump's new tariffs until April.
A month isn't a long time. What happens after the month is up?
So April 2nd is the date that Trump says he will put in place what he calls reciprocal tariffs. We don't quite know what they'll be. We don't know what their tariff rates will be or the products, but they'll be on products coming from all over the world. The general idea is that the U.S. will retaliate against countries that have tariffs on U.S. goods. Trump describes this as they tariff us, we'll tariff them, as if he wants to create a level playing field, although the tariffs on Canada and Mexico were not about that. They were about fentanyl and immigration. But at that point, April 2nd, we assume there would be tariffs on foreign car imports from all over the world. Here's how Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick on Fox News today described what happened.
What they said was, look, we're domestic American automakers, and if you put a 25% tariff on us, and you don't put it on the Germans, and you don't put it on the Koreans, and you don't put it on the Japanese, you're helping everybody but us. So come on. Can you help us?
And it turns out the president could help them, and he did, at least temporarily. So those tariffs on Canada and Mexico were put in place using emergency powers to try to curb illegal immigration and stop the flow of fentanyl. So Trump can put these tariffs on and hand out exemptions from them to corporations that lobby him, because this is a power that the president has under the emergency powers. Tariffs are his go-to economic tool. They're very well suited to his kind of broad, unchecked view of the powers of the executive branch. He doesn't need court approval or congressional approval. This is something he can do by himself.
What's the overall goal of these tariffs?
Well, that's a good question. There have been so many goals that Trump has talked about, it's hard to parse them all. As I said, for Canada and Mexico, it was to stop illegal immigration and fentanyl. At other points, he says it's about jobs. Here's Lutnick again from that Fox News interview, channeling the president.
Why are our Michigan jobs in Canada? Why are our Michigan jobs in Canada? And that's what the president's going to address. He's going to say, come on back. Come on back. We're going to build Michigan. We're going to build Ohio.
So the answer is the reason why they're in Canada is because it's hard to go back to being a completely self-sufficient economy that doesn't rely on trade with your neighbors after they've spent years transforming their businesses and becoming completely integrated into a free trade bloc.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson, and thank you.
Thank you.
Drug maker Eli Lilly is expanding its business of selling prescription medicines directly to consumers. The company is offering more vials of its obesity drug Zepbound to patients at a discount, but only if they skip their insurance. NPR's Sydney Lupkin has more.
Every month, roughly 100,000 people buy Zepbound directly from Eli Lilly through its website.
It's about the size of a small city.
That was David Ricks, Eli Lilly's CEO. Last summer, Lilly started selling vials of the lower doses of Zepbound online. Patients either need a prescription from their doctor or can get one online through a Lilly partner. Now the company is adding higher doses of Zepbound.
It's a cultural phenomena. It's used by millions of people in the U.S. and millions more would like to use it. So I think it's incumbent on us not just to invent great new medicines, but get them to patients.
The drug usually comes in an auto-injector pen, like an EpiPen. But the Lilly offer is for vials that patients then use with an old-fashioned syringe to inject themselves. It's a cheaper option, a few hundred dollars a month compared to more than $1,000 a month. The other catch is that to get the discounted vials, patients cannot use their health insurance. Novo Nordisk, which makes blockbuster Wegovy, announced today that it too will sell its obesity drug at a discount for people not using insurance. Dr. Ben Rome is a health policy researcher at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
This phenomenon of drug companies selling their products directly to consumers is definitely new.
But it wouldn't work for most medicines, he says.
This particular market, this anti-obesity market, is very kind of peculiar in some ways. And again, there's a lot of consumer demand, right, for these products. I mean, you don't see patients sort of knocking down doors to get, you know, blood thinners.
Ricks, Eli Lilly's CEO, says about 10% of the people who use Zepbound get the discounted vials.
It's not a panacea. We think actually a better way would be to have the normal healthcare system, doctors and patients connect and then use the insurance they've already paid the premium to reimburse them for a chronic disease like obesity. That's not working perfectly right now. Here, we'll do what we can.
That's because a lot of health insurers don't cover Zepbound or any drug specifically used to treat obesity. The number of people who need these drugs, coupled with their high sticker prices, has made it difficult for health insurance plans to cover them. For example, in North Carolina, the health plan for government workers decided not to cover the drugs. It would have increased monthly premiums for everyone by about $50 a month. Ricks says Eli Lilly is working to expand insurance coverage. Meanwhile, he says the company is not losing money on its discounted vials. Dr. Rome says he's not worried about Eli Lilly turning a profit. Zepbound brought in almost $5 billion in revenue last year.
This is not a question of, is Eli Lilly going to make enough money to recoup investment on the drug? They absolutely will.
Rome, an internist, says he talks with patients about these medicines every week. But he says most Americans won't be able to afford even the discounted obesity drugs.
Remember, Americans are already paying thousands of dollars per year on healthcare. So to say, like, well, there is this medicine available, but you have to pay for it out of pocket, it really serves a very small, you know, percentage of the population.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 2 in 5 American adults is obese. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Yesterday, in the hours before President Trump gave a speech to Congress, dozens of federal workers laid off under the Trump administration were getting help looking for new jobs. Reporter Andrew Seltzer was at a hastily organized transition workshop in Philadelphia.
In the basement of the Queen Memorial Library in South Philly, a group of former federal employees are exchanging war stories.
I found out on Valentine's Day.
I got the termination letter on Valentine's Day weekend.
I was one of the many thousands terminated on Valentine's Day.
That was Ava Miller, Pam, and Rachel Inman. Pam didn't want us using her last name because she's hopeful she might get her old job back. They're newly laid off. Ava from an unnamed federal agency. She's worried about unconfirmed health benefits. Pam worked for the Department of Health and Human Services, and Rachel, the USDA. All were probationary employees, a status for folks who are new to government or recently started in a new role. Janice Barlow, a 25-year Department of Commerce veteran, is here too.
Now I'm day two into forced retirement. So it's been extremely upsetting.
Barlow opted into the DOGE deferred resignation program about 20 minutes before it was shut down, afraid that if she didn't, she'd be laid off anyway.
I would have liked a couple more weeks to really see if I could have afforded it. Do I hang on? Do I risk? But it's done.
Barlow is here seeking camaraderie and is getting a free headshot, courtesy of a local photographer.
If you want to do a little smile. That's nice. I know, it's such a cheerful time of life to be.
I loved my job, so the memories will come.
Yeah.
Army Reservist Charlie Ellison organized the event. He's currently on parental leave from his government job and figured he had some time to help.
As a neighbor and a community member here in South Philadelphia, I think we've seen, you know, dozens of friends, neighbors, family members getting fired for what's been cited as poor performance. And we know the opposite is true. We know they're exceptional public servants. We know they're deeply passionate about helping others. So I think that's been the really heartbreaking thing about all of this.
Ellison used to run similar workshops for military members transitioning out of the service.
Here's a few of the tools I've been using lately, and you'll have these slides in our Google Drive that I'm going to send out, but feel free to take photos. Or
his presentation goes over how to network with LinkedIn, adjust resumes for the private sector, and strategies for using artificial intelligence.
Key caveats with leveraging AI, right? You've still got to do the work to put in your data. You can't just say, write me a resume for this job.
Having spent my entire career at one agency, this is all new.
Shannon Petty is one of several current federal employees here. After 15 years with the Social Security Administration, she still has her job, at least for now.
Things are very, very tense, and I think people are scared and uncertain about what the future is going to bring.
Meanwhile, several other states are recruiting laid-off federal workers. Here's New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, in a video on a state website.
The federal government might say you're fired, but here in New York, we say you're hired. In fact, we love federal workers. Whatever your skills, we value public service.
Even as some DOGE initiatives are overturned in court, President Trump and Elon Musk are pledging to make more staff reductions. Yesterday's workshops in Philadelphia were full, and there are already talks of holding more. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Stelzer in Philadelphia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has been a vocal skeptic of vaccination for years. In a Fox News editorial regarding the measles outbreak in West Texas, he did write that vaccines are, quote, crucial to avoiding potentially deadly disease, but he also stopped short of actually recommending them, writing, "The decision to vaccinate is a personal one." Elsewhere, he has repeatedly made the debunked claim that there could be a link between vaccines and autism. That particular myth long predates RFK Jr. The hosts of NPR's Throughline, Rund Abdelfatah and Ramtin Arablouei, have the history behind one of public health's most enduring falsehoods.
Dr. Wakefield, would you like to start this panel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, it's a great privilege to be here. The purpose of my testimony is to report the results of the clinical and scientific investigation of a series of children with autism.
April 6th, 2000. Doctors, researchers, and parents of children with autism have been called in front of Congress to testify about a potential link between autism and vaccines. Andrew Wakefield was among them. At this moment, in the year 2000, he's a researcher from the Royal Free and University College Medical School in London.
A superb scientist who was at a superb institution.
Sitting just to the left of Wakefield is
Paul Offit.
Paul Offit.
I am the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine.
At the time, Paul was also part of a committee that advised the CDC about the use of vaccines.
I was subpoenaed to testify about whether I thought it made biological sense that vaccines could cause autism, and I didn't.
Paul listens as Wakefield launches into his testimony.
As a little bit of background, this represents 12 years of intensive clinical and scientific research, collaborative research.
Wakefield is summarizing the results of research he published in 1998. In a renowned British medical journal called The Lancet. In that paper, Wakefield suggested a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, also known as MMR, and the development of autism in children.
For which he had no evidence. You could have published a paper saying, here's 8 children who recently ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich that now have signs and symptoms of autism, because it was really no better than that.
But when it was published, people in the medical field took it seriously.
Because it's fair enough, right? My child was fine, they got this vaccine, now they're not fine. Could the vaccine have done it? That is an answerable question. It's a scientific question that can be answered in a scientific venue, and was. And so study after study after study, more than a dozen studies, done in 7 countries on 3 continents, involving thousands and thousands of children.
None of them found any evidence that linked the MMR vaccine to the development of autism.
So asked and answered.
But the doubts Andrew Wakefield had sowed were powerful. And that's what landed Paul in front of Congress, testifying opposite Andrew Wakefield in April 2000.
My concern, Mr. Chairman, is that parents listening to or reading about this hearing might incorrectly conclude that vaccines cause autism. This is not the case. Vaccines are extremely safe and highly effective.
In that moment, did you have a sense of just how big this idea that he had launched into the world that vaccines cause autism was going to become?
No, not at all. I still believed at that time in a world dominated by logic and reason that it's okay to ask the question, it's okay to have the hypothesis, but that when that question has been thoroughly answered, that would end it. And I was just naive. I was wrong. It didn't end it at all.
Wakefield seems like he knew how to command a room. He knew how to
shape the narrative. And that seems to have been really important in terms of getting this idea traction.
He comes off as someone who's speaking truth to power, and that power is pharmaceutical companies who are never going to be seen as sympathetic. So if you're on the other side, I mean, you're just saying, look, this isn't true. I mean, this isn't causing autism, but you don't have anything to offer. You don't have a clear cause or causes of autism. He does. He's offering parents something, and we're not.
Wakefield's paper came out at a time when many parents were searching for answers.
Autism rates were just skyrocketing in a mind-blowing way.
This is Elena Conis, professor of journalism and history at the University of California, Berkeley.
In the early 2000s, everywhere you looked, every classroom, there were kids with autism diagnoses. They were all across the spectrum. The statistics coming out of the CDC were absolutely terrifying, and they just went higher and higher.
From the 1970s to the 1990s, the U.S. had seen a tenfold increase. Some people attributed the rise, at least in part, to greater awareness and changes in diagnostic criteria. But there wasn't a conclusive explanation.
Concerns about the connection between vaccines and autism were circulating for close to two decades before they were published in The Lancet.
And Wakefield's paper spoke directly to these concerns.
Wakefield becomes this high-profile individual. He had been one in England.
And he inspires other high-profile supporters.
We do not need that many vaccines.
Among the most vocal were
Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey.
Without a doubt in my mind, I believe vaccinations triggered Evan's autism.
Actress Jenny McCarthy and comedian Jim Carrey were dating at the time, and Jenny's son had been diagnosed with autism. Together, they organized a rally in the nation's capital called Green Our Vaccines.
I just want to start by asking the CDC one question. How stupid do you think we are?
RFK Jr. spoke at that rally.
And this is how they defend themselves. They hire these phony scientists. They produce these phony reports, so I know how to read them. So I did something that not a single
national news outlets turned out story after story about vaccines.
With more eyes on the movement, the Wakefield paper came under more scrutiny. The Lancet retracted it in 2010, and a British journalist named Brian Deer published an investigation revealing that some children in the study had already exhibited signs of autism before getting vaccinated.
You went through the sort of fallacies of the Wakefield paper. Do you remember when it was retracted and what your reaction to the retraction was and what happens to Wakefield?
My reaction was, it's too late. It should have never been published. You can't say anything about causality because there's no control group.
But were you surprised that even after the retraction, the narrative continued?
I'm not even sure if they'd retracted it a month later, it would have mattered. I think the cage door got open and the devil came out.
Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdel-Fattah, hosts of NPR's history podcast, Throughline. You can hear the full episode on the origins of the myth that vaccines cause autism wherever you get your podcasts.
This is NPR News.
Community organizers in North Carolina are trying to protect people without legal status by spotting and helping them avoid immigration agents. Borders Our Tom Holman is saying these efforts interfere with the rule of law. But community organizers say all they're trying to do is help their neighbors. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Mary Ellen Matthews has photographed the hosts and musical guests on Saturday Night Live for 25 years.
I'm putting everything into these images as I would for, you know, a fine art project. I consider it a fine art as well.
Her new book, after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Today, the Supreme Court rebuffed the Trump administration in the first case to reach the high court involving President Trump's sweeping efforts to eliminate foreign aid authorized by Congress. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
3 weeks ago, federal judge Amir Ali temporarily ordered the administration to leave the funding taps on while he considered arguments in the case. He later enforced that order by telling the government to pay its bills, in this case, to pay foreign aid contractors for work already completed. That prompted the Trump administration to appeal to the Supreme Court, contending that the judge had exceeded his authority. But by a 5-4 vote, the court refused to interfere, at least for now. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is granting U.S. automakers a one-month exemption from his stiff new tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico. As NPR's Windsor Johnston tells us, the temporary reprieve applies to vehicles that comply with a trade agreement that the first Trump administration negotiated with those countries back in 2020.
The White House announced its decision following talks with automakers, including Ford and General Motors. The goal is to prevent these companies from facing economic disadvantages because of the 25% tariffs. The reprieve comes amid broader concerns about rising car prices in the U.S. Industry experts say the new taxes could increase the cost of vehicles by at least $3,000, a big hit to both automakers and consumers.
NPR's Windsor Johnston, Trump went ahead with plans this week to impose 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico and doubled U.S. tariffs on Chinese-made products to 20%. Well, stocks finished higher after a choppy day of trading despite those tariffs. The Dow gained more than 400 points. This is NPR. Sesame Workshop has announced layoffs. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the news comes a day after about 200 of its employees said they wanted to form a union, and a couple of months after the show's future came into question.
In a statement, Sesame Workshop says, amid the changing media and funding landscape, we have made the difficult decision to reduce the size of our organization. A couple of months ago, Warner Brothers Discovery announced that Max would no longer fund the production of new episodes of Sesame Street after 2025.
Sunny days sweeping up.
Puppeteers and writers are already union members. This week, about 200 of Sesame Workshop's administrative colleagues announced their desire to form a union. Sesame Workshop says production of the show's 56th season will begin next month, but the company still has not announced a new distributor. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Texas Representative and former Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner has died just 2 months after taking office in Washington. A spokesperson for the Democratic congressman who filled the seat of longtime Representative Sheila Jackson Lee died last night after attending President Trump's address before Congress. Turner served 8 years as Houston's mayor and was elected in November to fill the seat left by Jackson Lee, who died last summer. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback, with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses, at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Why did Israel's intelligence agents fail to detect the October 7th Hamas attack in 2023? Well, Israel's domestic spy agency, the Shin Bet, is offering some answers. It's published a report on what went wrong, and NPR's Daniel Astrin read that report and joins us now from Tel Aviv. Hey there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Daniel, I mean, it's pretty unusual for an intelligence agency to reveal details about the ways in which it failed. How much have they revealed?
Surprisingly, they have revealed a lot of details. The Shin Bet is the main Israeli agency tasked with spying on Hamas, and it is quite frank in this report about what it got wrong.
Take us back, if you can, to the days and hours before that attack. How did it not see what Hamas was about to do?
Well, the Shin Bet says that its biggest failure was actually that it did catch wind of Hamas's battle plan, starting 5 years before the attack, and then once again 1 year before the attack. Hamas had codenamed this the Promise of Judgment Day, but Israel did not translate that into an actual threat to take seriously. The Shin Bet says it had a poor network of spies in Gaza, and that actually Hamas had even uncovered an Israeli intelligence operation a few years back. And then in the hours before the attack, the Shin Bet reported warning signs, but says that they misinterpreted them.
What were those warning signs?
They started around 1 a.m. The attack happened around 6:30 a.m., so it was in the hours before the attack. The Shin Bet report says that around 3 a.m., they saw Hamas brigades gradually activating their cell phone SIM cards. But they said they had seen Hamas do something similar the year before, so that warning was dismissed. And in general, Israel was afraid of sending Hamas the wrong message that it was seeking war, so Israel didn't want to overreact. Then at 4:30 in the morning, the head of the Shin Bet intelligence agency held a call with deputies and said, it appears that Hamas might be planning something, maybe just one kidnapping attempt. And so they decided to send one team of forces to the border with Gaza. But we know now that was not enough to thwart thousands of attackers who stormed across the border, killing nearly 1,200 people, taking 251 hostages, sparking the Gaza war.
Daniel, this wasn't just a failure of intelligence that night. It was a complete misunderstanding of what Hamas was capable and willing to do, correct?
That's right. The Shin Bet does talk about failures that were not just intelligence failures, but were policy failures that were ultimately the responsibility of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu had a policy of basically buying calm from Hamas by allowing Qatar to transfer millions of dollars to fund Hamas's government in Gaza. And the Shin Bet says in this report that it had warned Israel's leaders that Hamas was actually using that money to build up its military capabilities.
What do all of these findings mean for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, his office is furious at this intelligence report. Netanyahu himself blames the October 7th failure entirely on his security chiefs. His own military chief of staff actually stepped down today over his part in the failure. Netanyahu wants to remain in office. He has resisted taking any responsibility for the October 7th attack. He's resisting calls for an official state inquiry. And in a speech yesterday, he warned about what he called deep state bureaucrats, saying that an inquiry would be biased against him.
NPR's Daniel Astrin in Tel Aviv, thank you.
You're welcome.
Last night, President Trump told Congress that he ended what he calls the weaponization of law enforcement. One of Trump's top picks to run federal law enforcement is Dan Bongino. He's a former Secret Service agent turned pro-Trump podcaster. Now he's set to be the next deputy director of the FBI. To better understand how he'll lead the FBI, NPR reviewed more than 1,000 of Bongino's podcasts. And as NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports, Bongino has called for the FBI to be disbanded and for top Democrats to be put in prison.
Get ready to hear the truth about America on a show that's not immune to the facts.
The deputy FBI director has historically been an apolitical job.
Dan Bongino is a hardcore partisan. On his show, he looks direct to camera, usually wearing a t-shirt with a saying like, liberals suck, and he rants about how he believes the Democratic Party is waging a cold civil war against the country.
The left is right now. They are not wrong. The left is evil. I need you to understand that there's a difference here. It's not just that they're wrong on politics. They are evil.
Bongino uses the word evil a lot on his show and talks about his belief in the spirit realm and the presence of demons on Earth.
Demon energy is real. Demons aren't these horn-looking people with spiked tails. That's just in the movie. Demons are real. They're possessed by some energy, and they're here on Earth now. I want you to see what one of them looks like.
He then pulled up a clip of Pramila Jayapal, a Democratic congresswoman. Across hundreds of shows, another one of Bongino's targets is the agency he'll help lead, the FBI.
I'm very sorry to tell you, FBI is completely broken, and you are not safe from them if you are a conservative and especially a prominent one.
The previous FBI director, Christopher Wray, is a Republican, and he was appointed by Trump. But to Bongino, he was a totalitarian despot. FBI agents have historically leaned conservative. Bongino said they were, quote, thugs for the Democratic Party. And in 2022, after the FBI searched Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate for allegedly mishandled classified documents, Bongino said the United States had become a police state.
Our police state is right now no different from things you're seeing in Cuba, North Korea. Now, I don't like hyperbole. We haven't gotten to the mass systemic violence by the police state. But folks, sadly, I don't know where this is going to end.
Bongino also spread conspiracy theories about the FBI, claiming the Bureau had some illicit involvement in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and called it an inside job. And here's Bongino's solution for how to fix the FBI. Get rid of it.
Fire everyone involved in this stuff. Everyone, no excuses. Disband the entity. It is the only way at this point.
The FBI declined to comment for this story, and it seems unlikely that the Trump administration would take such a drastic step, though FBI Director Kash Patel has already talked about moving more agents from the Washington headquarters to field offices around the country. But our review of Bongino's podcast archives gives another signal about how he'll act as FBI Deputy Director, where he'll handle day-to-day operations. For years, he has said Democrats should be prosecuted, including former President Barack Obama.
Ladies and gentlemen, Obama should be locked up for this.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Because Hillary Clinton is a freaking criminal.
Democratic Senator Adam Schiff.
Adam Schiff, remarkably, I think should be in prison for some of the stuff he did.
And he said in 2023 that because the Department of Justice charged Trump, it was important to charge Democrats in retaliation, including former President Biden's family.
State attorneys general, it is time for you to now go out and start pressing charges against members of the Biden family. The Biden family committed a crime in your red state, which appears many have. It's time for them to get locked up in your state. Sorry.
Now, Bongino is going from podcaster to one of the top law enforcement officials in the country. As deputy director of the FBI, he will oversee all of the Bureau's investigations. He has said in that job, after a decade of right-wing podcasting, he'll put his politics to the side. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. America's ski resort industry has become increasingly corporate, as in they're being bought by a handful of conglomerates. So when a mountain in Colorado went up for sale, a neighboring town launched a bid to buy it. The goal? Keep the vibes relaxed and the costs down. Rachel Cohen with Mountain West News Bureau takes us there.
It snowed about 7 inches overnight at Eldora Mountain Resort, about an hour west of Denver. In the morning, the flakes are still falling.
So, yeah, should be a good day.
Getting ready to ski, Rebecca Burns says the small resort feels like a locals' mountain, with families and college kids, but not so many out-of-state vacationers. But the future of the hill is up in the air. The company that owns it, Powder, is putting it up for sale. Burns has one demand.
As long as it's not bought by Vail, that's all I really care about.
Vail Resorts is also based in Colorado and owns more than 40 ski resorts. Not everyone loves their flagship mountain here.
Like a posh, like pinkies out kind of mountain. That's not really what the locals want around here.
Vail and their big rival Alterra won't say whether they're interested in Eldora. There's no list of potential buyers, but the little town closest to the resort is trying to put together a bid for it. There's a coffee shop inside of train cars, an indoor carousel, a crystal shop, the old wooded town hall.
This building was built in 1874, and it's a very quirky building.
Jonathan Kane is the administrator for Nederland, population 1500. It was a former mining town revived by musicians and artists.
This was a center of kind of the counterculture hippie movement in the 60s and 70s, and it's always been a place that's been just a little bit different.
Now, Nederland serves as a gateway to outdoor recreation, and it's not intimidated by the price tag for Eldora, which the town estimates is between $100 to $200 million.
It is really important to the people of Nederland that this remains a real community where real people live and they raise their kids and they can work and play in the same places. And I think it ultimately will help us keep Nederland, Nederland.
There are definitely skeptics. Steve Trujillo works behind the bar at a Nederland pizza shop.
I don't see them having the money to improve it. We don't have the money to have a police station. We don't have money to have a bank. We don't have money for good sidewalks, for good roads. How do we have the money to buy a ski area?
Town Administrator Jonathan Kane says the town can swing the purchase despite its tiny tax base. It can sell municipal bonds, he says, and resort revenue will pay them off. He says there could even be a surplus that would subsidize things like sidewalks and water pipes. Michael Chillers grew up skiing small resorts and sees the romantic appeal of a small town owning the neighboring ski hill.
Just going up to the mountain every afternoon, taking the kids out for PE classes.
Now a professor at Colorado State University, Chillers wrote a book about the changing ski industry.
The ski area really controls a lot of the industry, a lot of the culture of these places. And so I see this as a reaction against that kind of corporate mega resort ownership.
Last summer, local investors in Vermont bought Killington Resort, and people in Bend, Oregon are pooling resources to try to buy Mount Bachelor. Nederland officials say the company that owns Eldora has invited town leaders to submit a bid. They say they're working toward finalizing a plan. The company that owns the resort declined to comment for this story. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Cohen.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. After Friday's contentious meeting in the Oval Office between President Trump, Vice President Vance, and Ukrainian President Zelensky, the White House was sent a letter. The author received the Nobel Peace Prize and is a pro-democracy hero in Poland. As NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz reports, the letter expressed to the Trump administration what the Polish government cannot.
The letter begins with, "Your Excellency, Mr. President," but that's where the honorifics end. It goes on to compare Trump and Vance's treatment of Zelensky to interrogations by political police under communist Poland, and it demands more respect for a leader whose soldiers are shedding blood to defend the free world. "We do not understand," the letter says, "how the leader of a country that is a symbol of the free world cannot see that." The author is Lech Wałęsa, former leader of Poland's Solidarity Movement, the first democratically elected president of Poland, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate for his leadership in opposing communist rule. His letter was signed by dozens of other former Polish political prisoners.
"Nobody wants to say anything too vivid, too aggressive towards, you know, Donald Trump and the United States. So the only people who can do this are people who are now retired."
Andrzej Bobinski is managing director of the Warsaw-based journal Politika Insight. He says the 81-year-old Wałęsa is able to voice an opinion many in Poland's political circles also possess, but are too scared to say, given Poland's close relationship with the U.S. and its historical antipathy towards Russia.
"Donald Trump is way too lenient and way too friendly towards Vladimir Putin, and a number of people are really shocked and scared with where this is heading. On the other hand, nobody wants to alienate the United States, and I don't think anybody has come out outright and said that we don't want to be friends with the United States anymore."
Certainly not Donald Tusk, Poland's prime minister, who made this statement after the Oval Office incident. "I know a narrative is being created, especially after that very strange Friday at the White House," said Tusk, "that would divide Europe and the United States. We cannot allow that to happen," he said. "Since the end of the Cold War, Poland has been one of America's closest allies in Europe," says Bobinski.
"I think that's changing. The attitude is changing. There's a huge generational shift. And I think that, you know, by the end of Donald Trump's term, Poland will be in a very different place."
And Wałęsa's scathing letter, says Bobinski, is a sign of Poland turning away from its longtime friend. But where it will turn towards is an open question for Poland and for the rest of Europe. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Photographer Mary Ellen Matthews says she has the best job in the world. And you've seen her work if you've ever watched this show in the last 25 years.
And live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
Matthews is Saturday Night Live's official photographer. She creates the portraits of hosts and musical guests every week. You know, the images that flash on the screen for a few seconds before the commercial. Her new book was almost titled All This for 3 Seconds. The actual title of the book is The Art of the SNL Portrait. She had to winnow down some 4,000 images to choose the ones in the book. And she told me one that she always knew would make the cut is the cover photo of Andy Samberg.
He is a olive in a martini glass with a pimento hat.
The pimento hat really makes it for me somehow. And he's sloshing around
me
in
too.
What looks like a real martini.
Yes. Well, that's the point, as we all kind of probably want to slosh around a martini once in a while. and the pimento hat was the cherry on top, so to speak.
The images range from the totally zany, like John Mulaney as the pilot of a paper airplane, to portraits that feel moody and introspective.
There's one in the book of Emma Stone that, you know, we did a very sort of old Hollywood take on her, and she emotes so much with her eyes, and, you know, she just hits the pose, and you just get so much from her.
This appears early in the book. It's a very
yes.
contrasty color photo. She's sort of gazing upwards, and the light hits her face just so, and she's got this sort of sweep of auburn hair and a deep red lip. It is very sort of classic glamour.
Yeah, it's nice to see these moments of sophistication along with the rubber chickens and the martinis, I think.
Mary Ellen Matthews grew up in New Jersey. Her father was a hobbyist photographer with a dark room in the basement.
for sure, I always knew I wanted to be working in photography. I never dreamed that I would end up here.
Her mentor was the show's first official photographer, Edie Baskin, who created the job 50 years ago. These images are called bumpers, and they have their roots in TV history. See, when Saturday Night Live started in the 1970s, network shows needed to cue local affiliates when it was time to cut away to commercials. On a late-night show, a photo of the host might flash on the screen with a message like, "More to come."
We'll be right back with the second half of the Richard Pryor Show.
As SNL founder Lorne Michaels writes in the foreword to this book, he wanted to create bumpers that felt like a part of the show's aesthetic, often funny, with Manhattan in their DNA.
We've done a lot of the imagery on the streets of New York.
Like a shoot with Timothy Chalamet in Central Park.
The word got out, apparently, so there are lots of people following us around.
Security had to keep all the fans at bay.
You know, years ago, it was a little simpler because people weren't with their iPhones all the time and recording, and it just didn't get out as much. And now everybody is shooting the same time we're shooting, so they kind of get ahead of us.
So just to describe this image, he is sort of like skipping in the air with an umbrella over his shoulders. It kind of looks like a Golden Age of Hollywood black and white film.
Yeah, something Parisian about it, too. I don't know what it is. I guess it's the lightheartedness.
Creating the bumpers every week is an all-out sprint.
We need about 8 or 9 images per show, 2 of the musical guests, and 7 or 8 of the host.
Sometimes that involves live animals or complicated costumes and set pieces. And this all unfolds while everybody's also writing and assembling the rest of Saturday Night Live each week. As you were putting this book together, was there an image that you saw differently when you revisited it outside of the weekly treadmill of putting on the show each week?
I think some of the portraits that are not as comedic and more, you know, just sits in a place of classic portraiture really have surprised me. And it's been really lovely to revisit these. And I think they're really well done. And I'm sort of proud of them.
Some artists obsess over every detail in their work. Mary Ellen Matthews doesn't have that luxury. Her images have that in common with the rest of Saturday Night Live. They don't go out into the world because they're ready, but because the clock strikes 11:30 p.m. on Saturday, and it's showtime. The new book of photographs by Mary Ellen Matthews is called The Art of the SNL Portrait.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the...